The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have main engine start. 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to the Friday morning California time Space Show program. And it's great to be here. Sunny, beautiful day in San Francisco. I hope wherever you are, it is equally as nice. So first of all, I want to say that we're on the 60-minute format today. So if you do have a comment or question for our guest, Mike Mongo, please get it in time, because we're doing 60 minutes, not 90 minutes. Our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners, so just be patient. We'll bring you up on the air as quickly as possible. You can also communicate with us through email, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and then also our blog, which is on our website, thespaceshow.com, all the way over to the far right upcoming show menu. This is the first show listed. Open up that page, which is our archive page, and scroll all the way down to the bottom where comments and questions are. And as soon as you post your comment or question, I'll get it and I will integrate it into our program. So don't forget, when you're at our website, thespaceshow.com, to check out our detailed website newsletter. It's center right in the homepage, and it is updated every Sunday after the Sunday show completes. Everything we do is archived, so you can listen right off of our website, or you can quickly download our programs. The Space Show store for T-shirts and things of that nature is in the upper left menu under support. And in addition, there is a Listen Live button in that upper left menu. This tells you how to listen to both a live and an archived Space Show program. Feel free to share this information with people you think would be interested in this programming. And then also on the homepage, center right, we have our support items. So remember, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with one O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org. And since this program lives on your contributions make it possible. Please note that if you are a U.S. federal taxpayer, you do get a donation for your gift. And the same is true if you pay California taxes. We are in California, a California Public Benefit Corporation. You can get a lot more information about our nonprofit status by visiting our parent company's website, onegiantleapfoundation.org, or simply email me, and I'll be happy to respond to your question and your comments. Also note, there's a big Amazon link in our homepage, and that's because Amazon has great programs. Wow. For supporting nonprofits, and if you click on that Amazon link, it will take you to our Amazon page, and you can see the different programs and how just your normal, everyday, routine Amazon and Amazon Prime purchases can help support the Space Show without any added cost to you. It's a really nice program that Amazon has to support nonprofit programs. In addition to our individual supporters that I talked about just a minute ago, which are essential to the Space Show program, we do have corporate sponsors, and you'll see their banner ads running across our homepage. Since we're on the one-hour format today, I'm not going to read their messages, but I definitely want to thank the Space Plan, Space Foundation, Orbital ATK, and AIAA, as well as Celestis, for their support and their help with keeping the Space Show going. Our corporate sponsors are really crucial to us. We do thank them for it. And we do have a couple of corporate sponsorship spots remaining open. If you are interested, don't hesitate to send me an email, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and I'll be happy to provide you with the information on corporate sponsorship. And I'm happy to bring back to the show today Mike Mongo. This time we're talking to Mike about his children's book. It's an award-winning book, The Astronaut Instruction Manual. It's published by Penguin, which is part of Random House. Mike is also the VP of Icarus Interstellar and the Strategic Director of the Starship Congress, and he serves on the Board of Students for the Exploration and Development of Space. This is the SEDS organization, which we have talked about many times on the Space Show. He is an astronaut teacher, so Mike annually encourages thousands of students in classrooms all over the world to pursue careers living, working, and playing in space. He has taught astronautics in Mexico, England, the Bahamas, Jamaica, Haiti, and the United States and Canada, and is the first U.S. American to teach in Cuban primary schools in over 50 years, with six trips to dozens of Cuban school classrooms since 2014. He was a 2017 ambassador to Yuri's Night, Next Generation Student Outreach Advisor for the NSS, and much, much more than that. His astronaut instruction manual has been optioned by Legendary Entertainment and is in pre-production for television. Mike, welcome to the show again. How are you?
Hi, David. Great to be here.
Tell us about the Astronaut's Instruction Manual. What is this book about, and who is it targeted for?
It is targeted for students who are 8 to 12, 8 to 13 years of age, who want to go to space, who want to live, work, and play in space. When I was, I'm 52 now, when I was 42, I had this moment that I often share with people where I was working as a marine science researcher, science communicator at a eco charter here in Key West, Florida. I'm based in Key West right now. And I was thinking about what my next career move was going to be. I had done this for a number of years, and I was satisfied with my work, and I was wanted to move on to the next thing to continue to grow, develop professionally and as a person. And I was putting away the boat one night. I was coming off the boat. We go out into the islands of the Keys and do all sorts of adventures and science experiments and all sorts of fun things. And reflecting on this, and at age 42, like I said, 10 years ago, I was going up the list, crossing everything off I had done and accomplished: college, military, world travel, everything. And I got to astronaut. And all of a sudden I realized that I was 42 and I wasn't an astronaut. And at the same time, I realized that at age 42, that if you're not an astronaut at age 42, chances are you're not going to get to be an astronaut. Well, the funny thing is that astronaut was the thing I wanted to be and do more than anything that I've ever done out of all the great stuff I've done in my life. It was number one. It was everything else started after that. And I just put it off and, you know, just in the back of my thinking, just thinking, you know, I'm developing skills that'll get me there one day. And then it took my breath away. Like I literally had a moment. I was like, wait a minute, like 42 years, a lot of students don't realize this, but when you get to 42, there is so much life experience behind you. You just can't believe all that you've accomplished and how much we go through. And then the bewildering part is that you've got pretty much that same amount, God willing, in front of you, yet to go. So I had, by my own reckoning, gone and done everything I'd really ever set out to accomplish or want to do. I didn't have anything else really left on the list, and the one thing that I wanted to do most of all was the thing that was going to be left unaccomplished. I had to think on the spot right there, what am I going to do? And I, as I was on these boats, these charter boats, working with the different crew members and engaging with people that would come out on the boats about all sorts of things. So I would get the information, communicate it to the crew and captains, and then they would share it with the people that come on the boats about those xanthellae algae and different weather, why weather conditions happen, why certain currents produce certain effects that are amazing to behold, and then actually hands-on with different creatures in the marine setting. And every so often on these boats, there would be students, young people, kids, who would be so enamored with whatever you were talking about, whatever was being talked about or shown, that they would literally transform right before your eyes, and you could, like, right in front of you, you could see that they were going to become a scientist or a meteorologist or a marine biologist. They would just be so smitten with the wonder of whatever it was. It could be dolphins. Dolphins are amazing to behold up close. And I was very much enjoying this experience, though it wasn't so common because there's a lot of grown-ups on the trip as well. There's every so often we would have young people. It was a mix. And I like that experience. It's something I think now, 10 years through this process that I've now embarked on, that I've come to realize as the joy of teaching, the real joy of teaching. And at that time, I was thinking, I want more of that. So I combined on the spot right there. I said, okay, so if I have to go the next half of my life and I can't be an astronaut, what will satisfy me? And it was right then, right there, it was like an epiphany. I'm an astronaut teacher. If I can't be an astronaut, I can be an astronaut teacher and make sure that all of the students, the young people that have dreams of space as I did, know that they have permission to pursue those dreams, and that because of just the juncture of where they happen to be born right now, here in the future, that they have the opportunity to live, work, and play in space. And so that I embarked upon that process right the next day. I started writing the astronaut instruction manual. Like I said, it was 10 years ago. I began speaking, learning, first of all, I immersed myself in a subject matter. I guess you could say I became a citizen scientist in that regard, because I didn't have a background in astrophysics or aeronautics or physics or engineering per se. That wasn't my background. My background was more computer technology and I would assist with different science endeavors, but I wasn't a full-time practicing scientist. And that led to speaking opportunities with classrooms. And then I finished the astronaut instruction manual, self-published it initially. This is 2008 maybe, and began going to classrooms, talking with every, teachers and classrooms and schools are always looking for these sort of opportunities to inspire students. And so if you have some credibility, you'll be welcomed into the schools and classrooms and even churches. And I just kept on doing that until I got invited to the DARPA to 100-year Starship public study space symposium, 100-year Starship public study symposium in Orlando in 2011. That was the first time I was invited somewhere as a professional. And really after that, it took off, David. That's really I had gone to space science conferences before, but to be invited to one. And then from there, one thing led to another. In fact, at that's where I came in contact with Icarus Interstellar for the first time. And then in 2014, William Gibson, the author, who I follow on Twitter and engage with every so often, recommended a new company that was coming out called Inkshares. And Inkshares is a traditional publisher with a crowdfunding front end. So they have a model that if you propose a book and put it on their site and then sell advanced copies of it at a certain number, show that there's an audience for it, they'll professionally publish your book. They're co-owned by Ingram, which is the largest book distributor in the nation. And I happened to get in at a really good time. It was the very beginning of this company, which is now a really big company. And that was one of their first big successes, the astronaut instruction manual.
So you sort of publish it online, and if the online version takes off, then they publish the actual book.
No, not at all. No. It works like this. You make it available, like people, it's like bidding on it. People say, okay, I like this book, so I'm going to buy an advanced copy of the book before it gets published. So I had to sell a lot, like 75, I'd sell like $10,000 worth of books before the whole thing kicked off. And then once I made that number, then it just went into regular traditional publisher, just the whole, we worked for a year putting the book together. It takes a year from the time the publisher accepts the book till it gets on the shelves. A lot of people don't realize that. Lots of people don't realize that. Writers, many writers, I did not realize that. And so when they accepted it, that was 2014, when it accomplished its crowdfunding goal, then it went into the regular publishing channel, and I went then editorial assistance, then graphic design, galleys. We had to get copies from the printer, and then pre-sales, interviews, and then the book debuted October 13th. Of 2015.
So the people who do the crowdfunding don't get the copy of the book right then. They
get it a year later.
They get it a year later.
Yeah.
And do they set your promos and your benefits and all of that for crowdfunding, or you do that yourself?
You are in charge of all of that.
Is it Kickstarter or Indiegogo, or do they care?
It is parallel to that. And I've seen, now I've got friends who are authors, like, Andrew Rader?
He's been on the show.
Yeah, he's a great guy. Terrific person, terrific.
So they have their own crowdfunding program.
Well, he did a children's book. I don't know if you know this, but he did. He wrote the book about going to Mars, which, it's one of my staples. And then he wrote a children's book, which is so cool. It's a young kid's book that introduces science concepts with a giraffe that goes to space. And he crowdfunded it on Kickstarter.
Uh-huh.
But the challenge with that is that after you crowdfund it, then you have to handle all the marketing and all the graphic design and all the publishing and all that stuff that I don't have any background in and I wasn't interested in learning. That's why we have publishers. So
right.
I think he's got a sequel to it after the success of the first one. I think he's gone a more traditional route in the sequel.
So Inkshares takes care of all of that, including the crowdfunding.
Yes.
Ah, so it's just kind of a turnkey deal if it works.
Okay, so like they don't take care, when you say they take care of the crowdfunding, I mean it's you set up your project on their site on Inkshares.
On their site,
David Livingston Space Show book, which would be great because you've got such a background of content that you could dive into, and then you put it up there, and because there's so many fans, and because you're so well established, you have people that will automatically support it. That was the same thing with me. Like, I had already been working for 10 years, almost 10 years at that time, and I had established a credibility, and I had an audience and following, and people were wanting something like this from me, and so they everybody rallied around the project, and it was up to me to communicate that the project was there and existed.
Yeah, you,
it's up to
you
the writer, the author.
Right. Did you get the money that came in on crowdfunding, or does Inc. Get the money?
It pays for the publishing.
So you don't. So it doesn't go to you?
I don't know how it's set up now. I have a different deal because I was there at the beginning.
Okay.
Yeah, so...
So there's some percentage or something probably that they...
Right.
Okay.
Right. So...
All right.
The book was done by... We had McFadden and Thorpe out of San Francisco. The book designers do the design. And I have a background in audience building and brand messaging and knowing how to communicate. And I know my audience. I know what 8 to 12-year-olds are into and like and what they don't like. And so it's funny because when we first got the book from the designers, this is an aside, but when we first got the book, the designers didn't have a take on what 8 to 12-year-olds want. And I got something to look more like that you would sell to ravers, like kids that are really into techno music and neon lights and stuff. And I had to explain, like, no, that what kids are into is Minecraft. What kids are into is nowadays, today, like, you know, fidget spinners are probably at the tail end of their success, but I still see kids wielding them every day. And Legos and that sort of thing. So we designed it with that in mind. But that, again, this is all, you know, as the author, you have a process that you go through, and the kids sort of trained me how to communicate with them, and that's how I wrote the book, and that's how we designed the book. And then since the book came out, then now I just travel all over the place. I travel all the time, going to classrooms all over the nation or Skyping in. I Skype into classrooms everywhere. And the publisher builds little tours for me that I go on, that I go to school districts in different areas. And so I'll hit a number of schools over a week's time. I'll stay the whole day at one school. And I work with kids from in any age group. I can work with kindergarten kids, students. I can work with early primary students, like first to third grade. I can work with fourth and fifth, who I love, sixth, seventh, and eighth, which are my people, or even high school. I often work with college students because I'm on the board of SEDS. Working with high school students is probably the biggest challenge of all the students that there are to work with.
Tell us what's in your book. Tell us a little something specific about your book.
Okay, here's the fun thing. Now, David, when you were a kid, did you want to go to space?
Yeah, but, you know, it wasn't a big part of it because when I was a kid, nobody was going to space. I mean, the space program, Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, happened.
What year were you born?
I was born in 46, so it all started to come together just as I was entering my teens.
Wow.
And so going to space wasn't something that we really thought about. We were still trying to launch a rocket and stuff like that. So I was a big believer in all the 50s and the 40s sci-fi movies and Earth Conquers the Flying Saucers, you know, and the day the Earth stood still and all that kind of stuff. So aliens and ETs and flying saucers and stuff like that were really interesting, and learning what was on the planets and, you know, was there life or anything there? That was really interesting. But the idea of people traveling to space, it was all based on Tom Corbett and Rocky Jones, Space Ranger, and, you know, the sci-fi TV movies of the day, or movies that you'd see in serials, you know, if you went to the movie theater on Saturday.
Sweet.
So it didn't start to change until we actually had humans going to space. But, you know, I don't remember what year Yuri Gagarin went to space, but I was probably...
Early 60, 61.
Yeah, I was probably, well, 60, let's just say 60 for the sake, so 46, so I was already 14 years old when that happened. But up till then, there wasn't really much of a concept of people going to space. It had not happened yet.
Mm. OK, Okay,
hard to imagine.
I was born in 65.
Yeah.
And when I was growing, as a, 65, I was, like, by the time I was five, that was 1970, we're right at the peak of, prime time Apollo years. And I remember the newspaper headlines even. It was the thing everybody talked about. And when I was growing up, all the playgrounds were made with space themes. And my mom, oh, God bless her, she encouraged me to read, and she read to me. She read to me all the time, and she read science fiction because I loved it. And she let me read comic books. She didn't care what I read as long as I was reading. And so books were always available to me. I was a big fan of sci-fi and cartoons, superheroes, and these sort of things. And I wanted to be an astronaut. You grew up knowing that we were going to be the next generation to live, work, and play. That's going to be our job. We're going to get to be in space. And it changed. And I think that a number of my peers, so I'm 52. So anyone from the age of, say, 45 to 65 in that window right there, there is a whole group of people that are sort of grieved or have a chip on our shoulders, our collective shoulders, that we didn't get to go to space. That's not me, because I made decisions in my life now that I work in the space industry and love it every day and give thanks for it. I wake up and say, wow, thank you. And I go to bed and I say, thank you. That was a great day. And getting to talk and work with these people who are so much smarter than me, I think that is... I just can't put a big enough emphasis on that you get to be with people whose ideas are different than your own and very well developed. And it's inspiring to be in these rooms. And then when people call me ask for my opinion, I'm just like, what?
So take us through your book. Let's talk actually what's in your book. What are you instructing kids
to
do? Well,
the reason I asked if you wanted to go to space is that I did want to go to space, and I didn't have permission. No one said, Mike, when you grow up, you can grow up to be an astronaut, and here's what you have to do. That did not exist. It was there in front of us, and we were like, yeah, when you grow up, you can be an astronaut, as in the same way you can be president. But it didn't – there was no process, really. It was nebulous. So, looking back, I realized that. I was like, wow, no one really – we didn't have people coming into classrooms and telling us, hey, you can live, work, and play in space. And even if they had, I don't know how it would have changed everything just because of his time space, where I happen to have been born, 65 as opposed to 85. And I thought about that, and I said, okay, so there's a whole group of kids out there, like my inner 10-year-old knows that he was missing something. He needed that book that gave him permission to imagine himself living, working, and playing, to imagine himself in a space future. And that's who I wrote the book for. I wrote the book for that 10-year-old who I carry with me everywhere I go. We all carry our inner 10-year-old, and that compass rose that points the way to the future that we wanted most of all. And I wrote this book for the 10-year-olds today, the preteens who are thinking. Because at that time, by the way, 8 to 12 right then is when we begin to imagine ourselves in careers and jobs. We begin to picture ourselves in roles. And so that's who I wrote the book for, is so the students who are beginning to think of what they can do in the future, what possibilities, what opportunities are open for them. And I speak in that voice to these students. I do not speak as, hey, here's what we are going to do. I speak as, my name is Mike Mongo, and I'm an astronaut teacher. And if you follow these guidelines, if you listen to these things that I have to say, then you can live, work, and play in space.
And what do you tell them to do?
And then I began to introduce different people who have different successes. And then I began to explain how a lot of times failure leads to success. That we have to go through failures to get to success. And these seem like really generic or cliche concepts, perhaps, to grown-ups. But to young people, we think of winners as people who win all the time. We think of sports figures who succeed as someone who's never lost or never had loss in their life. That's so far from the truth, you know. And then I also show internal techniques for success. Like one of the things I explained is how to slow down time. And it's been funny how people responded to this one particular thing. But I had a nephew who was lax on his homework and wanted to do other things. I was working with him to get his homework done. And he was being a real pest. And he was in middle school, and he was like, I don't want to do this. I want to do something else. I'm like, look, if you just knock this out, which is nothing for you, then we can go on and do the really fun stuff. This is easy stuff for you. And he's lagging. I was like, I'll tell you what. Since I'm here and you're here, and you don't want to do this, but it's wasting my time too, I'm going to slow down time. And I said, you see that clock right there? Watch it. And we began watching it together. And you know how slow a clock moves when you watch it, David?
Right.
Well, kids don't know that. I mean, within less than 5 minutes, I mean, he was in tears. Please speed time back up, please. I'm like, well, do the math problems. Do the math problems, we'll be done. And he did, and we went out and played after that. And so... But I remembered that moment really clearly, and I've used it so many other times to explain to students the importance of attention and focus and the power that you have within to do these sort of things. That's one really particular example of stuff that's in the book. There's also the stuff about imagining what qualities it will take for you to get to space. Like, do the things that challenge you. If you have a little bit of self-doubt, approach that thing. Look, don't turn away from problems, run to them. Don't turn away from work, run to work. And remember that working as a team is the thing that organizations like NASA and SpaceX and Virgin Galactic look for. They don't look for individuals who are better than everybody else but can't work with everybody. They look for individuals who bring things to the table and make what everybody else brings to the table better. Things like that. And then I go on, I go into some of the astounding science of everything. And I do talk about, for instance, interstellar space exploration, because we see in movies, when you were a kid, you were talking about these movies, these science fiction movies, and there's plenty today. Of course, Star Trek and Star Wars have only become more popular as time has gone on. And we talk about starships. Well, explaining what that means, explaining what the speed of light is, and how that acts as a limiter for what we can accomplish in travel, or an opportunity, when, you know, we talked about a couple, you touched on these a little bit, when we talked about Starship Congress and Icarus Interstellar, but a light year is 186,000 miles per second. And kids taught me the best way to communicate that is think about blinking twice and being at the moon. That is the speed of light. And the sun is so far away from us, It takes at that speed, two blinks and you're at the moon. It takes 7 minutes, over 7 minutes to get to the sun. I think it's 8 minutes and 20 seconds, actually. And that's how far away the sun is. Like, that just blows their mind. They're like, what? Space is that big? Yes. And it's so big that to get from our sun to the next nearest sun, which is what all those stars are that are twinkling in the night skies, the nearest one's going to take 4.3 years. traveling at that speed, and we can't move anywhere near that speed. And then they start to work it out in their heads. And that's how these things, when you get mind thinking about these things, engaging about these things, we begin to discern what things hold our attention, what things don't, and very interestingly, we also begin to figure out how to solve problems. Like when I love telling students that space is 100 miles straight above us. I love explaining that to them. I was like, how far? I ask all the time, how far away is space? And I got to tell you, the most popular answer for how far away space is 1,000,000 miles. Space is 1,000,000 miles away from us. That's what the most popular answer is from students.
Why do they say that?
It's because we think of space as so far away, and 1,000,000 sounds like a big number. And so they just match those two. Space is far away, and a million means a lot. So it's 1,000,000 miles away.
And when they learn 100 miles, what do they say?
They can't believe it. It's like, I preface it by explaining, I am going to tell you something that almost no grown up that you know knows. That you can ask almost any grown up how far away is space, and they won't be able to really give you the answer off the top of your head. In fact, when I had it, it's on the back of my book, that little piece of information, and when I told my publisher that, he said, that's not true. And I said, it is. Let me give you a couple phone numbers you can call. Or you can Google it, but you can talk with some NASA scientists, and they'll explain how that low Earth orbit is right there, and with that's where we can stay in space with adjustments, with the engines and a little bit of tweaking, and we can stay in space at 100 miles away.
Do you have a workbook that accompanies your book?
No, I don't. There's some workbook qualities in the astronaut instruction manual. Do you know what ad-libs are? Book's called ad-libs?
Yeah.
Yeah, so kids love those, and so I have some of that in the book.
It hadn't been out long enough for you to see if anybody who got the book has gone on to be an astronaut. So.
Okay, but that's a great question. Thank you for asking. Okay, since I started doing this 10 years ago, the students I first started working with, they didn't have the book, but they were being encouraged by me. So I got to mentor students along the way, like people whose parents I know, or whose parents have kids that I know, or people who are scientists or fellow space professionals who I know, and they want to encourage their students. And so the first two students that I've worked with are both studying in college astronautics right now. One's studying astrophysics, and the other is studying from the computer side of things, but they're both in space directions. It's like the biggest compliment that I have. One of the students I work with, we have a program here in Florida called Take Stock in Children, where they get a mentor that they meet with once a week for an hour. And I work in this program. I've worked in it for 7 years, and I'm on my second student now, graduating, and they get a full scholarship in a Florida college for going through this program. And the last student I graduated is now studying at UCF, Phil Metzger.
I know Phil.
Yeah, and so like I get to say, hey, you're going to the school, you get to work with this person that I know. This is great.
Well, so are you talking about Phil's daughter?
No. Phil lives up in a different part of Florida.
Right.
I live in Key West all the way to the bottom, but the student that I mentored down here went to UCF. I've met Phil's family. They came down to Key West, and we hooked up down here.
Okay, so this is someone who studied with Phil in college.
Now he's studying with Phil.
Okay, I got it. I thought you met
as a professor. Yes,
in Phil's family. Yeah, Phil's been on the show a couple of times. He's a great guy.
You know, he collects rock samples of everywhere that they travel.
No, I did not know that.
He's got in his office, the whole wall is little vials of the rocks from all the different places. It's beautiful.
Well, he'll have to go to the moon and collect some, right, in Mars.
I'm sure that's his dream. So, yeah, so a lot of students I work with, like, I mean, it seems to be success. And now, because I work with SEDS, here's a funny thing. Here's a great story there. This is one of my favorite. I love to tell this, share this. I'm 52. To be in SEDS, you have to be in college. So I wasn't in SEDS. SEDS wasn't around when I was in college. Well, part of the time. It was brand new when Peter Diamandis and I can't remember who, Rick Tomlinson started it. And so I went back to college to join SEDS. So that I wanted SEDS as part of my credit. I didn't anticipate that I would ever be on the board. I went back to college just to join SEDS.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. Well, I speak at the Space Vision conferences I've had for years. And starting in 2013. And I love SEDS. And I highly encourage any of your listeners who have kids who are moving in the college direction to explore students for exploration and development space. Please think that I would say that at least 50% of the people who belong to SEDS go into space careers.
Mike, have you been able to bring your book or your teaching and your work with kids into the Starship Conference that I'll be attending in a couple of weeks?
Yeah, absolutely.
How does it show up in the Congress?
Well, the Starship Congress is on the wrap up, it said so I work with SEDS now, and I became a board member, and now we reach to high school students now. We have started to do an outreach to high school with SEDS. And again, I just can't reinforce enough to people who are listening to the space show to, if you know somebody who is college age-ish, younger or in college, to encourage them to either join their SEDS chapter at their college or to start a SEDS chapter. I would like to say that. And now on to your question about Starship Congress. At the last Starship Congress at Drexel University, I gave a talk called Space is for Everybody. And that's based on Chris McCauley's famous line, Space is for Everybody. It's a terrific line, terrific quote. It's worthy of her for certain. And the thing about it is that if we don't make space for everybody, that it won't be for anybody, because it has to be to really do a serious space migration. To do settlements on the moon it's going to take more than just commercial enterprise. It's going to take pretty much a planetary commitment. And there's reasons to do that. It's the infinite amount of resource which is available to us. It's the technology and insight that we gain from going to space. We can solve so many health issues by what we learn in going to space. There's things that we can make in space that we can't make on Earth. And in doing that, we began to see that, well, Icarus Interstellar's mission is to produce an interstellar achievement, and we have an earmark of 100 years. That's a window based on the 100-year starship ideal. And by the way, the 100-year starship ideal about producing an interstellar achievement within 100 years' time came about, this is really interesting, David, because in 1865, Jules Verne wrote From Earth to the Moon. And then, 100 years later, we went to the moon, approximately. Very close. And some of the people, Stuart Brand and Pete Warden, you and I have talked about him before,
right.
and Dave Nalen from DARPA, came up with the idea. It's like, well, using that as a model, let's produce an interstellar achievement in that time. Let's come up with the idea now and start doing what it takes to get us there in 100 years. Well, at Icarus and Stellar, we have a lot of the we've developed models of potential starships, and there are any number of scientists working with the organization that produce ideas of how we could produce some sort of vehicle that could move from our solar system to another solar system. And it's very fanboy-ish, fangirlish, hobby-ish. Everybody has a passion for it. There's no one getting paid. It's collateral science. It's not something that anyone make building. It's not something people are doing as a career, which is a lot of good stuff happens that way. I mean, computers started that way. And so we began to think of this problem. And the funny thing about Icarus Interstellar is Icarus Interstellar is mostly a think tank more than anything else. Because of the challenges of interstellar space exploration, you know, getting from our solar system to another solar system, 4.3 light years away, you have to be very creative and open-minded in your thinking, not so that you would overlook, not that you allow in bad science, but that you become creative in ways to solve problems. So looking at this challenge of how do you produce an interstellar space accomplishment within the next 100 years, it becomes obvious that you have to include the students. You have to get kids involved in this because the interstellar space exploration movement is like a relay race. We carry the baton today, and we'll be handing it on to another at another time. Well, if you encourage the students, the young people, put their eyes in the direction of the sky and the star of another star, then they'll pursue that goal. They'll commit their whole life to it. So that's where it has tied into to Starship Congress. We have a few big ethos at Icarus and Stellar. One is build a starship. The other is spaces for everybody. And these are slogans that we put on wristbands and T-shirts and bumper stickers and then posters and pass out to schools and inspire young thinkers to think about these problems, these challenges, and become interested and connected with them and make them their own.
Will students come to the Congress? Do you have student programming?
We have student programming for like high school and older. Like the conference, the summit is really accessible in that regard. We make a point of it. We reach out to high schools in the area. We reach out to colleges in the area. We let them know that this is there. We at the colleges we reach out to the department heads, and then we've had a lot of, you know, this is our third Starship Congress, and college students being at the Starship Congresses, as I mentioned when I spoke to you on Starship Congress previously, that's one of the earmarks of the organization of the event.
Can we get your book at the Congress?
Yeah, sure, of course. We have a Kickstarter going on right now for Starship Congress, and you can get a copy of my book with a letter from me to your student, your person. Personalized letter, and I love that kind of stuff.
Speaking of the Congress, because you're coming toward the end of the hour, mm-hmm. Is there any new developments, any new excitement from when you guys did the show last Friday, a week ago?
I have to tell you, I'm sure there are. I have been so focused on the nuts and bolts of it that as a strategic director of the Congress, and that I have not, I'm a little behind on that information. I wish I had something to share other than, Inkshares, my publisher, is going to be one of the big sponsors of the event, as it turns out.
Are they going to be there?
Yeah.
Because I want to talk to them, because, you know, I have, I have been toying for the last 18 months. Originally, I was going to do it as the 15th anniversary of the space show, but that's come and gone, writing a book about the space show over the years, and was thinking of doing it as a crowdfunding program, but then it would be to self-fund the book that I would have to do and do all of that. So I'm really interested in what you're talking about with the InkShares concept, and we'll look forward to talking to him while I'm there.
Cool. Sweet. Yeah, you know, it'd also be really for a book like yours would be to include some letters from people who have been on your shows over the years because of the caliber of guests that you have, that which, you know, makes other podcasts just green with jealousy. But you've been doing it so long that you have the credibility, and that's the thing. That's one of the things I work to encourage students and everyone to understand, is that if you want to go after something, Arthur Ashe, the tennis player, I researched this extensively. He was attributed this quote that when he was asked how he became one of the top tennis professionals of all time, he answered, "You start where you are, you work with what you have, and you do what you can." And that's how I became an astronaut teacher. Like, if you Google astronaut teacher, there's four people that come up, and I'm one of them. And two of them are no longer with us, Sally Ride and Kristen McAuliffe. The other is Barbara Morgan. She is also in California. And that is after, you know, like, people are like, "Wow, how did you get this big success?" And I tell people, it was an overnight success. It just took 10 years.
I was going to ask you something else about
the book's being turned into a television show right now.
Oh, yeah. That was in the bio that I read. So what's the TV show about?
The TV show is fictionalized. So it is the executive producer of the show is Matt Tolmach, who did the last two Spider-Man movies.
Okay.
And Legendary did Pacific Rim, Godzilla, Superman versus Batman. They do all these big, big films, and they did Jumanji and the new Jumanji, which looks awesome. And they wanted to get into television, and so they picked up some properties. Mine happened to be one of them. They optioned out. My agent is United Talent Agency out of L.A., so I get to fly back and forth every so often. And that's Bill Nye's agency, and that's funny. It's like Tom Cruise's voice double did the voiceover for the book promo spot for my book because of my agency. Like, there's cool things that happen when these things start to roll. And then the book, the idea that they're working on is explaining how kids first started getting to go to space. That's the whole premise. And we started work with Doug Petrie. He was the showrunner, the writer for the first Daredevil series on Netflix.
Uh-huh.
And the upcoming Defenders series. And we may go back to that, but
when will we see it on TV?
I have no idea. It's been 1 year in development right now. The pitch just went to the studio maybe 3 weeks ago. I am really, really lucky in that as a first-time author, I am also a consulting producer on the show. Like a lot of other writers explained to me that's unheard of, but I have a great agent and a terrific publisher. InkShares is really a powerhouse. Adam Gomelin, I have to thank, like, more than I can put words to.
Last week you guys were keeping your call for papers open a few more days. So did that finally close, or are you still?
I'm pretty sure it closed. Good gosh. I mean, there's a lot. And you know, it's great. You get a lot of great science, and then you get a lot of not so great science. And it's a lot of work when you're going through all these different papers. And I just get to look over them. I don't really participate with I have smarter people than there's smarter people than I doing that work. Choosing which papers get selected.
So for anyone listening, that probably is closed by now.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
What else should we know about your book and what you're doing? Do you have another book in mind? Do you have a follow-up?
I got I'm actually handing over the sequel to the Astronaut Instruction Manual to the publisher this month. and it's the astronaut instruction manual 2. The first one ends on a note that precludes this follow up, and I'm finally at a place where I have something to communicate. I have to tell you that it has been tough communicating to students over the past 8 months because of the politics and everything that's going on. It doesn't affect students as much as, like, it doesn't change their idea about the awesomeness of the future. It definitely does affect grown-ups and teachers and classrooms and settings, but it does affect the conversations that students have with you. And they say things that you hear them getting directly from the news, which are so absurd and don't have any bearing on reality, that it makes you kind of do double duty to keep them on track with what's important about, if you have a vision for seeing yourself in space and for our space future, and letting, you know, not getting caught up ourselves as grown-ups in the direness of the situation when the U.S. doesn't commit to a Paris Accord and things like that. We get through these tough times, and on the other side of it, we'll look back and say, wow, it didn't look like we were going to get through that, but we do. And it's our job as grown-ups to encourage students and not get our being caught up in the moment tangled in our requirement to inspire them, our obligation to put the tools in their hands that they require to succeed. It's funny, people often complain about smartphones and tablets, but I have to remind all the people that are complaining that when we were kids and we were growing up, that how we succeeded is by the tools that were put in our hands, and that we are the people putting these tools in these children's hands. So then it's our obligation to show them how to best succeed with these amazing tools. I mean, David, come on. I mean, like, having a smartphone in your pocket, is that not the most amazing thing in the entire world?
Well, yeah, but a lot of it depends on what you do with it.
Exactly. It's like you have access. We have access to everything, pretty much every idea ever, pretty much. And letting them know that you are in charge of a supercomputer. Use your imagination. Use your creativity. Be inspired. Alan Kay, who's one of the speakers at the, he's doing a televised conference streaming type thing at Starship Congress. Alan Kay, he invented pretty much everything you ever use on a computer. He invented the GUI, the graphic user interface. You know, like, they were using printers in the 70s from the Park Research Center that he was part of, PARC, and he has said that if you want to be a millionaire, figure out how to do something in a better way. But if you want to be a billionaire, figure out something that has never been done. And for us as grown-ups, we become such realists that we forget that as youth, we don't have that restriction, and we have the freedom to think about anything because we don't have to pay for mortgages and car payments and house payments and medical bills and our children. We don't have to think, as kids, we don't think about any of that, and so we can solve these crazy problems. I love to tell kids that the person who invented television was 14 years old when he invented television. His name was Philo Farnsworth. And it wasn't until he was 21 that he was able to build the television. And then corporations who were building comparable television machines said that they invented it and took him to court. And his teacher came to court with the artwork that he originally depicted the television, and that's how he won the case. Like, that's not legend, that's history. And when I tell students that, it frees them to go and solve these problems. I say, if you see something in the world that you want to do, do it. Find people that believe in your ideas and support them, and then surround yourself with that, and then pursue it. And that's what inspires me every day, David.
Well, you're at the end of your hour. Aside from inspiring us, do you have any closing comments or a message you'd like to leave us or anything for the Congress that you want to motivate us with?
Well, I hope everybody who has the opportunity does come to Starship Congress. It's in Monterey, California, August 7th through 9th. We do have such a variety of speakers, yourself included, who bring all these ideas that are that have such far-reaching impact beyond an interstellar accomplishment. We're really figuring out how to make the future work for everybody. And that would be great if somebody on this show figured out that that's a great way to get connected with space. They had a passion for it, or somebody out there had a passion for space growing up and they forgot it. And they're hearing it, or maybe they haven't pursued it, but they've always had it. But if you take that first step, just take a step, write a blog, start talking about space on Twitter. Just be consistent. It doesn't take a lot. You can just do a little bit, but if you do it consistently, it's like little drops in a pool. It may take a long time to fill that pool, but the pool will fill over time, and then suddenly you got an amazing pool, and it's yours. And you know this because you did it. You started small, and now you're David Livingston with the space show, and everybody knows who that is. But it wasn't like that when you began.
Nobody knew what anything was.
And that's how this whole thing does. And this is such a terrific time to get into space. It's brand new. It isn't finished. It's just beginning. So that's my closing message.
Well, listeners, if you do get to the Congress this year, and it's coming up really quickly, make sure you look up Mike and talk to him about some of these ideas. He'll be there. Look up me as well, obviously, and Andreas, who was on last week. Also look up members of my panel. Kim is going to be there from Moonwords. It's actually her panel.
She's amazing.
John Josie is a great listener with lots of resources for the space show. And Dr. Ben Arroyo, who's probably one of the leading real lunar engineers and habitat engineers from the Rutgers University Department of Engineering. He's keynoting and going to be part of our panel. But there are other people there, too. So lots of people that you can network and communicate with, but find Mike. If you have a kid, talk to him about how you can get your child interested in space and science if they're not already interested in it. And,
yeah, I'm really easy to get a hold of, too, on the Internet. You can Google Mike Mongo, and it comes right up. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. I'm on all the platforms, really, and not halfway. I'm committed to them. I communicate. And if you do have some student who you think is going to be the next Mae Jemison or Neil Armstrong, let me know, and I can send them in the right direction. It'd be my honor.
Mike, I look forward to meeting you in a couple of weeks. And
same.
Thanks for here, and I'll be looking forward to looking over your book and doing something with it when I see you down in Monterey.
Okay. Thank you, David. Keep up the good work.
And listeners, speaking of Kim, she is on the show Sunday, and she'll be back with us regarding Moonwords, Kim Holder. So you want to tune in on that show as well. Everybody have a great weekend coming up. Keep looking up. Thanks to Mike, and goodbye from Mike and myself and the Space Show.